I'm John Marvel, class of 2003 at Amherst. I am here today on the phone with Matthew Karp of Princeton University. We're going to talk about his recent book. It's called This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. It's out. It's published by Harvard University Press, 2016. And this is the topic of today's conversation. So I'll just start by asking Matt to give us a summary of his basic argument in the book. What's this all about?
I'm surprised you didn't begin by asking about our sophomore year cohabitation in the Amherst dorm room, once occupied by David Foster Wallace. I'm surprised that that doesn't feature prominently here.
Well, maybe that can come up later. Yes, so for those, for those in the know, Matt and I shared a one-room double in Moore right off of the TV pit, and we have this working theory that this was the room once occupied by David Foster Wallace. And the theory is kind of built on all these little nuggets of information that appear in some of his books. So there you
absolutely.
Go.
And it's extremely relevant to the development of this book, too, and to the history of slaveholders in U.S. foreign policy, which you may or may not realize by the end of the interview indirectly. You probably won't realize it. Okay, so wait, my main argument? Should we do that?
Main argument. What's your argument here?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the introduction of the book, I think, lays out a lot of the sort of core contentions, which I think fall in sort of two categories. First is the kind of material and the sort of practical and the actual, the political, that slaveholders fundamentally dominated the United States government before the Civil War, which I think we're largely familiar with, but the book really pushes deeper into how that control was specifically concentrated in the parts of the government that operated foreign policy and military policy. So the State Department, military, and especially the Navy feature as really important sort of institutional places where slaveholders sort of controlled, directed, formulated, carried out U.S. foreign policy. They did so, the book argues, this is to connect to the sort of the second major argument, with a kind of confidence. It evolves, I guess, but they did so. The second argument is sort of more ideological and even intellectual, that they did so sort of in response to an international environment that changed over the course of the mid-19th century that begins with British abolition in 1833 that really reconfigures the political balance of power between slavery and freedom in the Western Hemisphere and sort of pushes Southerners to sort of see the United States as this chief defender of not just slave property, but the sort of system of slavery, strategically and ideologically. And then over the course of the 1840s and 1850s, slaveholders grow increasingly confident about the place of slavery in the modern world, in the economy, even geopolitically with the spread of European empires and sort of racist science, that slavery has a place in this world and that from their position sort of at the commanding heights of the American state, they act on this confidence and it shapes both U.S. foreign policy and then ultimately the decision to secede. So that's maybe not quite as brief as I could have been, but those are the sort of basic outlines of the argument.
Well done. Well done on the summary. Second question. Would you say that in writing the book that you're kind of filling in gaps in the historical record, or are you pushing back against existing theories that are out there that other historians have made?
Yeah, it's just I just have a pack of crayons and a bunch of holes. And I'm kind of like scrubbing.
I mean,
I don't want to
minimize what you're doing.
Into these
but I'm
gaps.
Just curious.
Yeah, I wonder if anybody ever sort of says like, yeah, there's a really important gap here that I've devoted, historiographical gap that I've devoted like a dozen years of my life to filling, and now it's filled. So.
Well, that's what we do in the. I mean, that's how I view social scientific research. Carving up these little niches.
Yeah, to be honest, historians do that a lot too, and it shouldn't be kind of poo-pooed, but I feel like there's a sort of a little bit more kind of maybe just a performative swagger about it where few scholars kind of want to be seen as doing that. They want to be seen as like transforming the field. So I'm included in that. or I'd like to be. I mean, I think, I don't know, on a number of levels, to be honest, the book is actually in line with at least one tendency of the recent scholarship, which is to think about slavery as an important element, American slavery is an important element in the, even a foundational element in the development of global capitalism and American capitalism specifically, as sort of contra older, and in some ways still dominant, sort of at least popularly dominant ideas about slavery, the kind of backward looking paternalistic institution that was a relic of, you know, feudal or early modern, arrangements that are inevitably going to be disturbed and overthrown by capitalism. And that, you know, so in the sense that, but the book doesn't really go hard on that because it's not fundamentally about making the case that slavery was or was not capitalistic. I think it's about, what it does do though is, I think, demonstrate more persuasively to me than like a lot of the other books out there that slaveholders really, and especially slaveholding leaders, really did believe that it was progressive and powerful and productive and had a future. And that that consciousness and that sort of belief in slavery guided U.S. foreign policy. And really, you can't understand how why the South seceded or why the Civil War happened without thinking about it in these kind of international terms and without thinking about slaveholding international confidence.
Yeah, you talk, I mean, you use this word confidence, and one of the things I picked up on in the book is, and I didn't know this, this I found really interesting, was that there was this, you know, there were these Southern elite intellectuals who were consciously making a case for slavery as, I mean, you say that your intention wasn't to kind of make this case about how it was a driver of capitalism, but they do, these intellectuals were, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they were kind of crafting this case wherein they argued that slavery is this engine that can drive an economy, and in fact, it can sort of like prop up a prosperous Western civilization. I mean, this intellectual argument was out there, and these elites who were in government kind of drew on it self-confidently to in crafting this foreign policy. I mean, I found that kind of, I didn't know that this intellectual philosophical case was out there to be drawn on.
Yeah.
To kind of legitimate.
I would say that like scholars and maybe even, you know, sort of history buffs are familiar with one version of a pro-slavery argument that is kind of like, usually, you know, the historian Eugene Genovese is the kind of most well-known exponent of this of this view, which is that slaveholders essentially, you know, trumpeted the kind of paternal and organic qualities of a sort of master-slave relationship, which had sort of mutual obligations. You know, the slave, unlike the northern worker, for instance, slaves, you know, had to be fed by their bosses because they were owned by them, in effect. And that that's the kind of basis of the pro-slavery argument, is that it was like sort of different and better in a kind of humble, more paternalistic way than, you know, rapacious free labor arrangements in the north. But, you know, if you really dig into it, the way that slaveholding politicians especially mobilized pro-slavery arguments, they really didn't, I mean, they talked about paternalism, but I think, I mean, when I sort of dug into the, just reading the Congressional Globe or reading their most important journals, reading newspapers, you know, or reading political speeches, what they're fundamentally doing is making a case for slavery. I mean, they're using the kind of confident, optimistic, boosterish language of the 19th century of industrial capitalists and of other kind of aggressive actors on the world scene, but they're doing it on behalf of slavery. And and it's a fundamentally international case. It's not about how the plantation operates as much as sort of how the world market operates, and that, you know, emancipation in the West Indies, for instance, in Britain's colonies, has failed to produce the kind of productive staple agriculture that the sort of export of sugar that the slave economy did, because, you know, the freed people, quite reasonably from my perspective, did not want to labor at starvation wages on a sugar plantation when they could cultivate, you know, a wider range of goods on sort of self-sufficient peasant economy. So sugar exports in Jamaica and so on drop everywhere, which sort of for the Southerners confirms that slavery is, you know, coercive, racially organized labor really is necessary to produce things like sugar, cotton, coffee, these key goods that they see as like the fuel for the Industrial Revolution. So, and there's a whole wider range of arguments they make, but that aren't just economic, about slavery's relationship to modernity, which we can talk about, but I know you've got other stuff.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Britain, and you know, obviously a big argument of the book is that Southern slaveholders had an international view of slavery, and I was particularly interested in how just sort of, I mean, I thought there was almost this strain of paranoia in Southern elites' reactions to Britain's position on slavery. So, I mean, first, tell the listeners what exactly the Southern elites were reacting to. What was it that Great Britain did that had them all sort of worried? And, why were they so, they really come across as paranoid about this.
It's interesting. There's a chronology here that's important that's like can be a little bit confusing when you think about Southerners and slaveholders in Britain, because on the one hand, the book begins with their reaction to British abolition, which really sets in the mid-30s, in the early 1840s, it's fair to characterize it as paranoid and concerned about British anti-slavery undermining American slave property. And yet by the end of the period that the book covers, by the Civil War, the South is looking, the Confederacy is looking to Britain for strategic assistance against the North. So there's really a sort of transformation of attitudes. I would say in the first half of the book is really, in the 1840s especially, I'd say the turning point's probably around the annexation of Texas or the war with Mexico in the late 1840s. But in the first half of the book, Southerners really are concerned that Britain, having now abolished slavery in its colonies, in the Western Hemisphere at least, is kind of waging a strategic cold war against American slavery and wants to kind of, they have a sort of domino theory of Britain's anti-slavery politics where they, you know, first they're going to come for Cuba, then they're going to come for Brazil, and then they're going to kind of surround the slave South, isolate it, and eventually sort of undermine slavery, American slavery itself. And, you know, to fight this, they end up wanting to do all sorts of stuff like bolster the American Navy, make diplomatic connections with various slaveholding places. The most prominent of these is the very intimate connection that they make with the Republic of Texas, which leads to annexation. And in some sense, they're kind of successful at this. In the first half of the book is a story of like their sort of how the South, the United States really, under Southern leadership, under people like President John Tyler and Polk, Secretary of State Upshur, Abel Upshur, and John C. Calhoun, they kind of fend off British abolitionism strategically and set the stage for a period in the 1850s where Britain kind of backs off a lot of its anti-slavery strategic commitments, and the South senses that it's becoming more ideologically sort of, it sort of acquiesces that slavery is here to stay, and is actually a critical part of the world economy, and Southerners begin looking to Britain as a potential ally rather than a hostile rival.
Yeah.
Again, kind of long-winded there.
The South did kind of seem to have this swagger by the end of the book. They're really confident in themselves. How about a counterfactual now? How do you think U.S. foreign policy would have looked during the period if the South hadn't have had so much power in the federal government?
That's really interesting. I mean, I don't know how, I mean, part of it probably sort of depends on where you want to like draw, you know, you want to like run the film forward from what period, you know, how does slavery sort of, is it like there is no cotton gin or something, or, you know, it would sort of depend on the contours. But in general, I would say, what absolutely makes the South distinctive from all the other slave societies in, you know, really in human history in the 19th century, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, is the enormous political power of both the economic dynamism and the political power of slaveholders within the state. So, if you took that away, if you made slavery less dynamic and sort of smaller and a smaller feature of both the economy and the political power base, you might have a situation that where slavery, you know, ultimately could be sort of surrounded and contained, and you could have a sort of a more peaceful emancipation process a la the British West Indies in the 1830s, where, you know, I think the reason the Civil War happened is precisely because slaveholders were so powerful and so confident, unlike pretty much any other slaveholding class in the world. I mean, you could make an analogy to Brazil, where slaveholders were really, were generally in charge of the state, but Brazil never developed a kind of aggressive pro-slavery politics in quite the same way that the American South did. And in other places, slaveholding classes were generally politically weak, were dependent on colonies and, you know, those sort of metropolitan centers in Britain or France or Spain that were not nearly as dependent on slavery, and so kind of had to knuckle under, ultimately, unlike the South.
Yeah. Interesting. So how about one of the things that I found interesting was I even read the acknowledgments, which are quite wittily written, by the way. You come up with all these really clever ways to say thank you to people.
if you read or write books like academic monographs, like the acknowledgments are usually, I think most like historians will like read that first, so they can actually nip out, you know, how this book actually got written.
One other sort of random silly thing I noticed in reading the book was you clearly had to, you couldn't keep using the word just for aesthetic reasons. It would be clunky. Slavery, slavery, slavery. So there are all these, like, you bound labor, right? I mean, did you have some sort of algorithm where, oh, it's been three sentences since I used the word slavery. I have to use bound. I mean, I noticed that you kind of came up with these clever synonyms for slavery.
Yeah, throw servitude in there sometimes, or, bondage.
Yeah.
It's complicated, actually. I think that is a great aesthetic dilemma for historians of slavery, although, you know, maybe not the most significant one.
No, it's not. That's just something I noticed. But anyway, in the acknowledgments, this is more serious. You said that whatever didn't kill the book made it stronger. In the course of you, I mean, it sounded like this was germinated. This development of this project was ongoing for over a decade. And you took it and you presented it at conferences, and, you know, you even gave it, I mean, I assume you gave part of the book as your job talk when you're on the academic market. And again, you say whatever didn't kill the book made it stronger. So I'm curious about what sorts of critiques you encountered in presenting the book or parts of the book.
Well, I think, I mean, to be honest, the project is old enough that even though now it, when I sort of began, it felt like a very old-fashioned sort of traditional project in the academy, in the context of where, say, when I started grad school in 2004, where the kind of field stood at that point, you know, this was like, it was like, oh, I wanted to look at, I was initially got into it by thinking about the annexation of Texas and British diplomacy. That's what I actually wrote my undergrad thesis, mostly at sea level of Frost Library, about that. And it was tradition, it was diplomatic history, quote unquote, which is, you know, a very unfashionable field, certainly at the time. And I remember even some of my undergrad sort of advisors at Amherst being like, yeah, I don't really know if you can get jobs doing this kind of, you know, I mean, this work is interesting or whatever, but I don't really know if there's a lot of momentum in the world to sort of just study these elites.
Little side note, and we can't strike this if this is too sort of embarrassing to you, but I remember that you were kind of a little upset that the undergraduate dissertation didn't get high honors or something.
Yeah. We're definitely.
I remember
definitely
you used the phrase.
That.
One of the members of the committee used the phrase disparagingly. The phrase "diplomatic peacocks" strutting around, right? So
no, well,
at
okay,
that time
we'll
it wasn't
that
fashionable.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It was like you've got all these like diplomatic peacocks. I mean, peacocks strutting around, but what's the relationship to broader historical or historiographical issues? And I do think that there was some resistance in the early period of the project, but the great irony to that is that over the course of writing the dissertation in the book, and, you know, goodness knows it took long enough, is that by the time the book comes out, it's actually part of this extremely, I would even call it trendy, wave of historical writing about both about slavery and capitalism, and about the cosmopolitanism of slaveholding elites, and fundamentally about kind of transnational approaches to U.S. history, which is in some sense how old-fashioned diplomatic history has been rebranded as a way to think about the relationship between the United States and the world more broadly. And in a weird way, my book, which began from a really old-fashioned place, ended up being really trendy. But you asked about like pushback. I would say initially there was some skepticism, you know, on the part of my own advisors in grad school that it might be a little narrow. But the slaveholding elites might not be sort of a sufficiently, you know, significant base to sort of carry this whole book through. But, you know, I kept reading about, and then also in some sense, maybe this ground had been covered because political historians have been writing about these elites for decades and decades. But I sort of found that it hadn't been, and that actually all of that political history almost always pushed either A, back towards domestic party politics, which is important, but not really where this book goes, or B, towards, you know, and I got questions about this, like, is your work that different from people who emphasize, you know, Southerners' interest in building a Caribbean empire? That's something that there actually is a lot of, like the filibusters, you know, these sort of groups of mostly drunken Americans who sort of set out to attempt to conquer Cuba or Nicaragua in the 1850s. And there is a lot of really good scholarship on that, but the book doesn't really focus on those guys partly because there is such good coverage and because the book doesn't see territorial expansion as the heart. I don't see territorial expansion as the heart of what Southerners were most interested in. What they wanted, above all, was to preserve slavery in a hemispheric context. And so that might require American expansion, i.e. the annexation of Texas, but that also might require a sort of diplomatic, strategic, naval relationship with Cuba that sort of dissuades anti-slavery powers like Britain from coming in on Cuba, but doesn't necessarily require annexation. And I think, like, that sort of demonstrating that I had something new to say about that kind of old diplomacy between, say, the United States and Cuba, you know, in relation to slavery, is something that was a challenge for the book. But I think, I don't know. Yeah, like I said, I cockily said that it made the book stronger. So who knows?
Yeah,
that's
the naval,
for the reviewers to determine.
What? Was the kind of focus on the I think it was the third chapter on how the Southern strategy involved the expansion of the Navy, was that viewed as kind of a surprising finding within the historical community?
Yeah, that was kind of like my first article, so in grad school, where I sort of was like, whoa, some of this stuff is sort of hidden in plain sight. I mean, I did do a decent amount of archival work for the book, but it wasn't really about discovering new unseen documents. It was about reading things like the Abel Upshur's, you know, report of the Secretary of the Navy in 1841,
Matthew Morey, right?
I mean, yeah, Matthew
there
Morey,
some, there
right?
There are some obscure figures kind of who were pulling the levers within the new emerging naval bureaucracy.
Yeah, Matthew Morey, still an important figure in Virginia, I understand.
Yeah, this was kind of funny to me because I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and the elementary school my daughter will go to if we stay in this particular neighborhood is Morey, and I never knew that was actually short for Matthew Morey, and I had no clue who Matthew Morey was until I read your book and you talk all about
it. Yeah, if you go
Matthew
to Richmond.
Morey, he was a genteel Southern planter, right, who was kind of really in the weeds of naval strategy and bureaucratic organization.
Yeah, and he was an important naval scientist. You know, if you go to Richmond and you kind of walk down Monument Avenue, and it's the Paris of the sort of dead Confederacy. You've got giant memorials to Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, Stonewall Jackson, and then at the end of the run, you have Matthew Morey, who is not famous at all today, but was famous even in the late 19th century when they put up all of these giant Confederate monuments. Because he was the sort of preeminent oceanographer and naval nautical scientist of the 19th century. He calculated all these wind and chart times so you could figure out how to get from New York to San Francisco around the Cape Horn, you know, taking the maximum efficient route. But what gets forgotten with Matthew Morey, I mean, well, everything's forgotten now, But the Confederate, the kind of Confederate and post-Confederate tributes to him sort of missed the fact that he was a pretty ardently, pretty ardent defender of slavery. He worked for the, ultimately he did work for the Confederacy. And that he saw the U.S. Navy as a kind of tool to extend American power and to preserve the power of slavery. And a lot of his suggestions were about naval reorganization, were picked up by Abel Upshur, another Virginian who is Secretary of Navy under Tyler and who the book, talks about in some depth too.
Yeah, I don't think many people who send their kids to Moria Elementary know about his pro-slavery views. I think if they did, they'd be a little, they might have a name change campaign going if they knew about that.
Yeah, he's flying under the radar a little bit, probably.
Yeah. So, you know, that brings up a question about, you seem to have been really buried deep in the archives for this. I picture you in these, like, you know, musty, like, libraries coming upon these quotes that confirm your argument. And so my question is, did you kind of have this general theory and you went out there and started looking for confirmatory, disconfirmatory evidence? And then you sort of, you know, you comb through the archive and you find this important material and you're all, oh, this is awesome. This is a great quote for my book. It's really impressive because I've read some of the footnotes, not all of them, and you're quoting these obscure journal articles from the mid 19th century and you were really buried in the archives.
I'm really disappointed that you only read most and not all of the footnotes. I find that unacceptable for this conversation. I think our listeners, however many they are, extremely disturbed by this. I don't know. I mean, I did do archival research. I went down to the Southern Historical Collection and did a bunch of weeks down there in North Carolina, where I stayed at Amherst graduate Seth Bernard O3's parents' house for several weeks and was not bitten by his ferocious dog, Milo, which was nice. And I think, you know, and I did a lot of work at the Library of Congress and the National Archives and a bunch of other places. But I think the heart of the book, actually the sources that carry the book's argument, are not dusty, obscure things that nobody has seen in 100 years, but really stuff that is pretty much, much of it is available either in published or certainly in digital form. Now so much has been digitized. And it's just stuff that people haven't looked at in light of a kind of international struggle over slavery. And once you start looking, so to go to your process question, like, it's true, once I sort of had a hypothesis, you know, there's an inevitable, I guess, amount of kind of bias in this situation, but it really was hard to miss slaveholders talking about foreign policy and about the international politics of slavery. It wasn't even so much that I had to dig. It was, you know, if you read DeBow's review, which is the most important, the most widely circulated Southern journal, James, the editor, is a superintendent of the census in the Pierce administration, a pretty influential sort of, you know, press and, you know, political figure. I mean, every issue concerns the international politics of slavery and the United States' sort of role as a strategic and ideological defender of slavery. And the thing about these Southerners is, before the war, when it comes to slavery, yeah, you just don't have to look. They'll say anytime you want them to say something, like Alexander Stevens, the future vice president of the Confederacy, or DeBow, or even Jefferson Davis, anytime you want them to say something just like really aggressive about the wonders of slavery as a engine of modern civilization, they'll just say it. It's not, you don't have to like comb through, tedious heaps of stacks of papers to find like this damning evidence. It's just sitting, it's all over the primary sources. And, you know, it's interesting that people can even maintain a historical argument that slavery wasn't fundamental to American politics or to the sectional crisis or the Civil War, because they've obviously, not only have they not read enough of the sources, they probably haven't read a single source, because it's just impossible to miss.
Yeah. Well, all of your research makes for a great book, and I strongly recommend it to the listeners. Are we missing anything? Is there anything else that you feel needs to be said about the book?
No, I got in Seth's parents' dog Milo, so I think that's really
What about you mentioned that we talked about Moore, Dorm, and Foster Wallace. Was this sort of started all the way back then, this project?
Yeah, I did write my undergrad thesis for Gordy Levin's diplomatic history course, which I think has probably inspired a lot of academics and foreign policy thinkers over the course of, you know, many decades there at Amherst. But yeah, in the semester that covered early U.S. foreign policy really got to me. And I felt like that period of foreign relations was sort of less explored, you know, in my undergraduate mind it was anyway. And I wrote on the thesis on the annexation of Texas and British foreign policy. And that was the germ of, I mean, I've been dealing with this, you know, with John C. Calhoun in one manner or another for, I guess, like 14 years. It's really appalling.
Yeah, Calhoun is all over the book. He's all over the book.
Yeah.
I really liked it, and I'm glad.
Well, thanks, man. Thanks for the interview.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for reading most of the footnotes.